Disc 6.
Chapter 15. Dermot Craddock looked down at the last name and address he had written down in his notebook. The telephone number had been rung twice for him, but there had been no response. He tried it now once more. He shrugged his shoulders, got up, and decided to go and see for himself. Margot Bence's studio was in a cul-de-sac off the Tottenham Court Road. Beyond the name on a plate on the side of a door, there was little to identify it, and certainly no form of advertising. Craddock groped his way to the first floor. There was a large notice here, painted in black on a white board. Margot Bence, personality photographer, please enter. Craddock entered. There was a small waiting room, but nobody in charge of it. He stood there, hesitating, then cleared his throat in a loud and theatrical manner. Since that drew no attention, he raised his voice. "Anybody here?" He heard a flap of slippers behind a velvet curtain. The curtain was pushed aside, and a young man with exuberant hair and a pink and white face peered round it.
"Terribly sorry, my dear," he said. "I didn't hear you. I had an absolutely new idea, and I was just trying it out."
He pushed the velvet curtain farther aside, and Craddock followed him into an inner room. This proved to be unexpectedly large. It was clearly the working studio. There were cameras, lights, arc lights, piles of drapery, screens on wheels.
"Such a mess," said the young man, who was almost as willowy as Hayley Preston. "But one finds it very hard to work, I think, unless one does get into a mess. Now, what were you wanting to see us about?"
"I wanted to see Miss Margot Bence."
"Ah, Margot, now, what a pity. If you'd been half an hour earlier, you'd have found her here. She's gone off to produce some photographs of models for Fashion Dream. You should have rung up, you know, to make an appointment. Margot's terribly busy these days."
"I did ring up. There was no reply."
"Of course," said the young man. "We took the receiver off. I remember now, it disturbed us."
He smoothed down a kind of lilac smock that he was wearing.
"Can I do anything for you? Make an appointment? I do a lot of Margot's business arrangements for her. You wanted to arrange for some photography somewhere? Private or business?"
"From that point of view, neither," said Dermot Craddock. He handed his card to the young man.
"How perfectly rapturous," said the young man. "CID. I believe, you know, I've seen pictures of you. Are you one of the big four or the big five? Or is it perhaps the big six nowadays? There's so much crime about. They'd have to increase the numbers, wouldn't they?" "Oh, dear, is that disrespectful?" "I'm afraid it is. I didn't mean to be disrespectful at all. Now, what do you want Margot for? Not to arrest her, I hope."
"I just wanted to ask her one or two questions."
"Well, she doesn't do indecent photographs or anything like that," said the young man anxiously. "I hope nobody's been telling you any stories of that kind, because it isn't true. Margot's very artistic. She does a lot of stage work and studio work, but her studies are terribly, terribly pure, almost prudish, I'd say."
"I can tell you quite simply why I want to speak to Miss Bence," said Dermot. "She was recently an eyewitness of a crime that took place near Much Benham at a village called St. Mary Mead."
"Oh, my dear, of course. I know about that. Margot came back and told me all about it. Hemlock in the cocktails, wasn't it? Something of that kind. So bleak it sounded. But all mixed up with the St. John ambulance, which doesn't seem so bleak, does it? But haven't you already asked Margot questions about that? Or was it somebody else?"
"One always finds there are more questions as the case goes on," said Dermot.
"You mean it develops? Yes, I can quite see that. Murder develops. Yes, like a photograph, isn't it?
It's very much like photography, really, said Dermot. Quite a good comparison of yours.
Well, it's very nice of you to say so, I'm sure. Now about Margot, would you like to get hold of her right away?
If you can help me to do so, yes.
Well, at the moment, said the young man, consulting his watch, at the moment she'll be outside Keats's house at Hampstead Heath. Oh, my car's outside. Shall I run you up there?
That would be very kind of you, Mr.
Jethro, said the young man. Johnny Jethro.
As they went down the stairs, Dermot asked, Why Keats House?
Well, you know we don't pose fashion photographs in the studio any more. We like them to seem natural, blown about by the wind, and, if possible, some rather unlikely background. You know, an ascot frock against Wandsworth Prison, or a frivolous suit outside a poet's house.
Mr. Jethro drove rapidly but skilfully up Tottenham Court Road, through Camden Town, and finally to the neighbourhood of Hampstead Heath. On the pavement near Keats' house, a pretty little scene was being enacted. A slim girl, wearing diaphanous organdy, was standing clutching an immense black hat. On her knees, a little way behind her, a second girl was holding the first girl's skirt well pulled back, so that it clung around her knees and legs. In a deep, hoarse voice, a girl with a camera was directing operations.
For goodness sake, Jane, get your behind down. It's showing behind her right knee. Get down, flatter. That's it. No, more to the left. That's right. Now you're masked by the bush. That'll do. Now hold it. We'll have one more. Both hands on the back of the hat this time. Head up. Good. Now turn round, Elsie. Bend over. More. Bend. Bend! You've got to pick up that cigarette case. That's right. Oh, that's heaven. Got it. Now, move over to the left. Same pose, only just turn your head over to your shoulders. So.
I can't see what you want to go taking photographs of my behind for, said the girl called Elsie rather sulkily.
It's a lovely behind, dear. It looks smashing, said the photographer. And when you turn your head, your chin comes up like a rising moon over a mountain. I don't think we need bother with any more.
Hi, Margot, said Mr. Jethro. She turned her head.
Oh, it's you. What are you doing here?
I brought someone along to see you. Chief Inspector Craddock, C.I.D.
The girl's eyes turned swiftly onto Dermot. He thought they had a wary, searching look, but that, as he well knew, was nothing extraordinary. It was a fairly common reaction to detective inspectors. She was a thin girl, all elbows and angles, but was an interesting shape for all that. A heavy curtain of black hair fell down either side of her face. She looked dirty as well as sallow, and not particularly prepossessing to his eyes, but he acknowledged that there was character there. She raised her eyebrows, which were slightly raised by art already, and remarked,
"And what can I do for you, Detective Inspector Craddock?"
"How do you do, Miss Bence? I wanted to ask you if you would be so kind as to answer a few questions about that very unfortunate business at Gossington Hall, near Much Benham. You went there, if I remember, to take some photographs." The girl nodded.
"Of course. I remember quite well."
She shot him a quick, searching look.
"I didn't see you there. Surely it was somebody else. Inspector...
"Inspector Cornish?" said Dermot. "That's right. We were called in later."
"You're from Scotland Yard?"
"Yes."
"You butted in and took over from the local people, is that it?"
"Well, it isn't quite a question of butting in, you know. It's up to the chief constable of the county to decide whether he wants to keep it in his own hands or whether he thinks it'll be better handled by us."
What makes him decide?
It very often turns on whether the case has a local background or whether it's a more universal one. Sometimes, perhaps, an international one.
And he decided today that this was an international one?
Transatlantic, perhaps, would be a better word.
They've been hinting that in the papers, haven't they? Hinting that the killer, whoever he was out to get Marina Gregg and got some wretched local woman by mistake. Is that true, or is it a bit of publicity for their film?
I'm afraid there isn't much doubt about it, Miss Benz.
Well, what do you want to ask me? Have I got to come to Scotland Yard?
He shook his head. Not unless you like. We'll go back to your studio if you prefer.
All right, let's do that. My car's just up the street.
She walked rapidly along the footpath. Dermot went with her. Jethro called after them.
So long, darling, I won't butt in. I'm sure you and the inspector are going to talk big secrets.
He joined the two models on the pavement and began an animated discussion with them. Margot got into the car, unlocked the door on the other side, and Dermot Craddock got in beside her. She said nothing at all during the drive back to Tottenham Court Road. She turned down the cul-de-sac, at the bottom of it, drove through an open doorway.
"I've got my own parking place here," she remarked. "It's a furniture depository place, really, but they rent me a bit of space. Parking a car is one of the big headaches in London, as you probably know only too well. Oh, I don't suppose you deal with traffic, do you?"
"No, that's not one of my troubles."
"I should think murder would be infinitely preferable," said Margot Benz.
She led the way back to the studio, motioned him to a chair, offered him a cigarette, and sank down on the large puff opposite him. From behind the curtain of dark hair, she looked at him in a somber, questioning way.
"Shoot, stranger," she said.
"You were taking photographs on the occasion of this death, I understand."
"Yes."
"You'd been engaged professionally?"
"Yes. They wanted someone to do a few specialized shots. I do quite a lot of that stuff. I do some work for film studios sometimes. But this time I was just taking photographs of the fate, and afterwards a few shots of special people being greeted by Marina Gregg and Jason Rudd. Local notabilities or other personalities, that sort of thing."
"Yes, I understand that.
You had your camera on the stairs, I understand?"
"A part of the time, yes. I got a very good angle from there.
You get people coming up the stairs below you, and you could swivel round and get Marina shaking hands with them. You could get a lot of different angles without having to move much."
"I know, of course, that you answered some questions at the time as to whether you'd seen anything unusual, anything that might be helpful. They were general questions.
Have you got more specialized ones?"
"A little more specialized, I think.
You had a good view of Marina Gregg from where you were standing?"
She nodded.
"Excellent."
"And of Jason Rudd?"
"Occasionally, but he was moving about more. Drinks and things, and introducing people to one another. The locals to the celebrities, that kind of thing, I should imagine. I didn't see this Mrs. Badcock. I didn't see her drink the fatal draught or anything like that. In fact, I don't really think I know which she was."
"Do you remember the arrival of the mayor?"
"Oh, yes, I remember the mayor all right. He had on his chain and his robes of office. I got one of him coming up the stairs, a close-up. Rather a cruel profile. And then I got him shaking hands with Marina."
"Then you can fix that time, at least, in your mind. Mrs. Badcock and her husband came up the stairs to Marina Gregg immediately in front of him." She shook her head.
"Sorry, I still don't remember."
"That doesn't matter so much. I presume that you had a pretty good view of Marina Gregg, and that you had your eyes on her and were pointing the camera at her fairly often."
"Quite right, most of the time. I'd wait till I got just the right moment." Do you know a man called Ardwick Fenn by sight?
Oh, yes, I know him well enough. Television network, films too.
Did you take a photograph of him?
Yes. I got him coming up with Lola Brewster.
That would be just after the mayor?
She thought a minute, then agreed.
Yes, about then. Did you notice that about that time Marina Gregg seemed to feel suddenly ill? Did you notice any unusual expression on her face?
Margot Benz leant forward, opened a cigarette box, and took out a cigarette. She lit it. Although she had not answered, Dermot did not press her. He waited, wondering what it was she was turning over in her mind. She said at last, abruptly, "Why'd you ask me that?"
"Because it's a question to which I am very anxious to have an answer, a reliable answer."
"Do you think my answer's likely to be reliable?"
"Yes, I do, as a matter of fact."
"You must have the habit of watching people's faces very closely, waiting for certain expressions, certain propitious moments." She nodded her head.
"Did you see anything of that kind?"
"Somebody else saw it too, did they?"
"Yes. More than one person, but it's been described rather differently."
"How did the other people describe it?"
"One person has told me that she was taken faint."
Margot Benz shook her head slowly.
"Someone else said that she was startled."
He paused a moment, then went on. "And somebody else describes her as having a frozen look on her face."
"Frozen," said Margot Benz thoughtfully. "Do you agree to that last statement?"
"I don't know. Perhaps."
"It was put rather more fancifully still," said Dermot, "in the words of the late poet Tennyson. The mirror cracked from side to side. 'The doom has come upon me,' cried the Lady of Shalott."
"There wasn't any mirror," said Margot Benz. "But if there had been, it might have cracked."
She got up abruptly.
"Wait," she said. "I'll do something better than describe it to you. I'll show you."
She pushed aside the curtain at the far end and disappeared for some moments. He could hear her uttering impatient mutterings under her breath.
"Oh, what hell it is," she said as she emerged again. "One never can find things when one wants them. I've got it now, though."
She came across to him and put a glossy print into his hand. He looked down at it. It was a very good photograph of Marina Gregg. Her hand was clasped in the hand of a woman standing in front of her, and therefore with her back to the camera. But Marina Gregg was not looking at the woman. Her eyes stared not quite into the camera, but slightly obliquely to the left. The interesting thing to Dermot Craddock was that the face expressed nothing whatever. There was no fear on it, no pain. The woman portrayed there was staring at something. Something she saw, and the emotion it aroused in her was so great that she was physically unable to express it by any kind of facial expression. Dermot Craddock had seen such a look once on a man's face, a man who a second later had been shot dead.
"Satisfied?" asked Margot Benz.
Craddock gave a deep sigh.
"Yes, thank you. It's hard, you know, to make up one's mind if witnesses are exaggerating, if they are imagining they see things. But that's not so in this case. There was something to see, and she saw it."
He asked, "Can I keep this picture?"
"Oh, yes, you can have the print. I've got the negative."
"You didn't send it to the press?"
Margot Benz shook her head.
"I rather wonder why you didn't. After all, it's a rather dramatic photograph. Some paper might have paid a good price for it."
"I wouldn't care to do that," said Margot Benz. If you look into somebody's soul by accident, you feel a bit embarrassed about cashing in. Did you know Marina Gregg at all?
No.
You come from the States, don't you?
I was born in England.
I was trained in America, though. I came over here, about 3 years ago.
Dermot Craddock nodded. He had known the answers to his questions. They had been waiting for him among the other lists of information on his office table.
The girl seemed straightforward enough. He asked, "Where did you train?"
"Rheingarten Studios.
I was with Andrew Quilp for a time. He taught me a lot."
"Rheingarten Studios and Andrew Quilp."
Dermot Craddock was suddenly alert. The name struck a chord of remembrance. "You lived in Seven Springs, didn't you?" She looked amused. "Well, you seem to know a lot about me. Have you been checking up?"
"You're a very well-known photographer, Miss Benz.
There have been articles written about you, you know.
Why did you come to England?"
She shrugged her shoulders.
"Oh, I like a change. Besides, as I tell you, I was born in England, although I went to the States as a child.
Quite a young child, I think.
5 years old, if you're interested."
"I am interested.
I think, Miss Benz, you could tell me a little more than you have done."
Her face hardened. She stared at him.
"What do you mean by that?"
Dermot Craddock looked at her and risked it. It wasn't much to go on. Rheingarten Studios and Andrew Quilp and the name of one town. But he felt rather as if old Miss Marple were at his shoulder egging him on.
"I think you knew Marina Gregg better than you say."
She laughed.
"Prove it. You're imagining things."
"Am I? I don't think I am. And it could be proved, you know, with a little time and care.
Come now, Miss Benz, hadn't you better admit the truth?
Admit that Marina Gregg adopted you as a child and that you lived with her for 4 years?" She drew her breath in sharply with a hiss.
"You nosy bastard," she said.
It startled him a little. It was such a contrast to her former manner. She got up, shaking her black head of hair.
"All right. All right, it's true enough.
Yes. Marina Gregg took me over to America with her. My mother had 8 kids. She lived in a slum somewhere. She was one of hundreds of people, I suppose, who wrote to any film actress that they happened to see or hear about, spilling a hard luck story, begging her to adopt a child a mother couldn't give advantages to. Oh, it's such a sickening business, all of it."
"There were 3 of you," said Dermot. 3 children, adopted at different times from different places."
"That's right. Me and Rod and Angus. Angus was older than I was. Rod was practically a baby. Had a wonderful life. Oh, wonderful life. All the advantages."
Her voice rose mockingly.
"Clothes and cars, and a wonderful house to live in, and people to look after us. Good schooling, and teaching, and delicious food. Everything piled on. And she herself, our mom in inverted commas, playing her part, crooning over us, being photographed with us, ah, such a pretty sentimental picture."
"But she really wanted children," said Dermot Craddock. "That was real enough, wasn't it? It wasn't just a publicity stunt."
"Oh, perhaps.
Yes, I think that was true. She wanted children.
But she didn't want us. Not really. It was just a glorious bit of play acting. My family. So lovely to have a family of my own. And Izzy let her do it. He ought to have known better."
"Izzy was... Is it all right?"
"Yes, her third husband, or her fourth, I forget which. He was a wonderful man, really. He understood her, I think, and he was worried sometimes about us. He was kind to us, but he didn't pretend to be a father. He didn't feel like a father. He only cared really about his writing. I've read some of his things since. They're sordid and rather cruel, but they're powerful. I think people will call him a great writer one day. And this went on until when? Margot Bence's smile curved suddenly. Until she got sick of that particular bit of play-acting. No, that's not quite true. She found she was going to have a child of her own. She laughed with sudden bitterness, and then we'd had it. We weren't wanted any more. We'd done very well as little stopgaps, but she didn't care a damn about us, really. Not a damn. Oh, she pensioned us off very prettily, with a home and a foster mother and money for our education. A nice little sum to start us off in the world. Nobody can say that she didn't behave correctly and handsomely. But she never wanted us. All she wanted was a child of her own. You can't blame her for that, said Dermot gently. I don't blame her for wanting a child of her own, no. But what about us? She took us away from our own parents, from the place where we belonged. My mother sold me for a mess of pottage, if you like, but she didn't sell me for advantage to herself. She sold me because she was a damn silly woman who thought I'd get advantages and education and have a wonderful life. She thought she was doing the best for me. Best for me. If only she knew. You're still very bitter, I see. No, I'm not bitter now. I've got over that. I'm bitter because I'm remembering. Because I've gone back to those days. We were all pretty bitter. All of you? Well, not Rod. Rod never cared about anything. Besides, he was rather small. But Angus felt like I did. Only I think he was more revengeful. He said that when he was grown up, he would go and kill that baby she was going to have. You knew about the baby? Of course I knew. And everyone knows what happened. She went crazy with rapture about having it, and then when it was born, it was an idiot. Well, serve her right. Idiot or no idiot, she didn't want us back again. You hate her very much. Why shouldn't I hate her? She did the worst thing to me that anyone can do to anyone else. Let them believe that they're loved and wanted, and then show them that it's all a sham. What happened to your two, I'll call them brothers, for the sake of convenience? Oh, we all drifted apart later. Rod's farming somewhere in the Middle West. He's got a happy nature, and always had. Angus? I don't know. I lost sight of him. Did he continue to feel regretful? I shouldn't think so, said Margot. It's not the sort of thing you can go on feeling. The last time I saw him, he said he was going on the stage. I don't know whether he did. You've remembered, though, said Dermot. Yes, I've remembered, said Margot Bence. Was Marina Gregg surprised to see you on that day? Or did she make the arrangements for your photography on purpose to please you? She? The girl smiled scornfully. She knew nothing about the arrangements. I was curious to see her, so I did a bit of lobbying to get the job. As I say, I've got some influence with studio people. I wanted to see what she looked like nowadays. She stroked the surface of the table. She didn't even recognize me. What do you think of that? I was with her for 4 years. From 5 years old to 9. And she didn't recognize me. Children change, said Dermot Craddock. They change so much that you'd hardly know them. Even I have a niece I met the other day, and I assure you I'd have passed her in the street.
Are you saying that to make me feel better? I don't care, really.
Oh, what the hell, let's be honest, I do care. I did. She had a magic, you know, Marina. A wonderful, calamitous magic that took hold of you. You can hate a person and still mind.
You didn't tell her who you were?
She shook her head. No, I didn't tell her. That's the last thing I'd do.
Did you try and poison her, Miss Benz?
Her mood changed. She got up and laughed. What ridiculous questions you do ask. But I suppose you have to. It's part of your job.
No, I can assure you, I didn't kill her.
That isn't what I asked you, Miss Benz. She looked at him, frowning, puzzled.
Marina Gregg, he said, is still alive.
For how long?
What do you mean by that?
Don't you think it's likely, Inspector, that someone will try again? And this time?
This time, perhaps, they'll succeed.
Precautions will be taken.
Oh, I'm sure they will.
The adoring husband will look after her, won't he? And make sure that no harm comes to her.
He was listening carefully to the mockery in her voice.
What did you mean when you said you didn't ask me that? She said, harking back suddenly.
I asked you if you tried to kill her. You replied that you didn't kill her.
Well, that's true enough, but someone died.
Someone was killed.
You mean I tried to kill Marina, and instead I killed Mrs. What's-her-name?
If you'd like me to make it quite clear, I didn't try to poison Marina, and I didn't poison Mrs. Babcock.
But you know perhaps who did.
I don't know anything, Inspector, I assure you.
But you have some idea.
Oh, one always has ideas.
She smiled at him, a mocking smile.
Among so many people it might be, mightn't it, the black-haired robot of a secretary, the elegant Haley Preston, servants, maids, a masseur, the hairdresser, someone at the studios. So many people. And one of them mightn't be what he or she pretended to be.
Then, as he took an unconscious step towards her, she shook her head vehemently.
Relax, Inspector, she said. I'm only teasing you.
Somebody's out for Marina's blood, but who it is, I've no idea.
Really. I've no idea at all.
Chapter 16. At number 16, Aubrey Close, young Mrs. Baker was talking to her husband. Jim Baker, a big, good-looking, blonde giant of a man, was intent on assembling a model construction unit.
Neighbours, said Cherry. She gave a toss of her black curly head. Neighbours, she said with venom.
She carefully lifted the frying pan from the stove, then neatly shot its contents onto two plates, one rather fuller than the other. She placed the fuller one before her husband.
Mixed grill, she announced. Jim looked up and sniffed appreciatively.
Well, that's something like, he said.
What is today? My birthday?
You have to be well nourished, said Cherry. She was looking very pretty in a cerise and white striped apron with little frills on it. Jim Baker shifted the component parts of a stratocruiser to make room for his meal. He grinned at his wife and asked,
Who says so?
My Miss Marple, for one, said Cherry. And if it comes to that, she added, sitting down opposite Jim and pulling her plate towards her, I should say she could do with a bit more solid nourishment herself. That old cat of a white knight of hers gives her nothing but carbohydrates. It's all she can think of. A nice custard, a nice bread and butter pudding, a nice macaroni cheese, squashy puddings with pink sauce, and gas, gas, gas all day. Talks her head off, she does. Oh, well, said Jim vaguely. It's invalid diet, I suppose. Invalid diet? Said Cherry and snorted. Miss Marple isn't an invalid. She's just old. Always interfering, too. Who? Miss Marple? No, that Miss Knight. Telling me how to do things. She even tries to tell me how to cook. I know a lot more about cooking than she does. You're tops for cooking, Cherry, said Jim appreciatively. There's something to cooking, said Cherry. Something you can get your teeth into. Jim laughed. I'm getting my teeth into this, all right. Why did you, Miss Marple, say I needed nourishing? Did she think I looked run down the other day when I came to fix the bathroom shelf? Cherry laughed. I'll tell you what she said to me. She said, you've got a handsome husband, my dear. A very handsome husband. Sounds like one of those period books they read aloud on the telly. I hope you agreed with her, said Jim with a grin. I said you're all right. All right, indeed. That's a nice lukewarm way of talking. And then she said, you must take care of your husband, my dear. Be sure you feed him properly. Men need plenty of good meat meals, well cooked. Hear, hear. And she told me to be sure and prepare fresh food for you and not to buy ready-made pies and things and slip them in the oven to warm up. Not that I do that often, added Cherry virtuously. You can't do it too seldom for me, said Jim. They don't taste a bit the same. So long as you notice what you eat, said Cherry, and aren't so taken up with those strato cruisers and things that you're always building. And don't tell me you bought that set as a Christmas present for your nephew Michael. You bought it so that you could play with it yourself. Oh, he's not quite old enough for it yet, said Jim apologetically. And I suppose you're going on dithering about with it all the evening. What about some music? Did you get that new record you were talking about? Yes, I did. Tchaikovsky, 1812. That's the loud one with the battle, isn't it? Said Cherry. She made a face. Our Mrs. Hartwell won't half like that. Neighbours. I'm fed up with neighbours. Always grousing and complaining. I don't know which is the worst. The Hartwells or the Barnabys. The Hartwells start rapping on the wall as early as 10:40 sometimes. It's a bit thick. After all, even the telly and the BBC go on later than that. Why shouldn't we have a bit of music if we like? And always asking us to turn it down low. You can't turn these things down low, said Jim with authority. You don't get the tone unless you've got the volume. Everyone knows that. It's absolutely recognised in musical circles. And what about their cat, always coming over into our garden, digging up the beds just when I've got it nice? I'll tell you what, Jim. I'm fed up with this place. You didn't mind your neighbours up in Huddersfield? It wasn't the same there, said Cherry. I mean, you're all independent there. If you're in trouble, somebody'd give you a hand, and you'd give a hand to them. But you don't interfere. There's something about a new estate like this that makes people look sideways at their neighbours. Because we're all new, I suppose. The amount of backbiting and tale-telling and writing to the council and one thing and another round here beats me. People in real towns are too busy for it. You may have something there, my girl. Do you like it here, Jim? The job's all right. And after all, this is a brand new house. I wish there was a bit more room in it, so that I could spread myself a bit more. It'd be fine if I could have a workshop. I thought it was lovely at first, said Cherry. But now I'm not so sure. The house is all right, and I love the blue paint, and the bathroom's nice. But I don't like the people, and the feeling round here. Did I tell you that Lily Price and that Harry of hers have broken it off? It was a funny business that day in that house they went to look over. You know, when she more or less fell out of the window, she said Harry just stood there like a stuck pig. I'm glad she's broken off with him. He's a no-good if ever I saw one, said Jim. It's no good marrying a chap just because a baby's on the way, said Cherry. He didn't want to marry her, you know. He's not a very nice fellow. Miss Marple said he wasn't, she added thoughtfully. She spoke to Lily about him. Lily thought she was crackers. Miss Marple? I didn't know she'd ever seen him. Oh, yes, she was round here walking the day she fell down and Mrs. Badcock picked her up and took her into her house. Do you think Arthur and Mrs. Bain will make a match of it? Jim frowned as he picked up a bit of Stratocruiser and consulted the instructional diagram. I do wish you'd listen when I'm talking, said Cherry. What did you say? Arthur Badcock and Mary Bain. For the Lord's sake, Cherry, his wife's only just dead. You women! I've heard he's in a terrible state of nerves still. Jumps if you speak to him. I wonder why. I shouldn't have thought he'd take it that way, would you? Can you clear off this end of the table a bit? Said Jim, relinquishing even a passing interest in the affairs of his neighbours. Just so that I can spread some of these pieces out a bit. Cherry heaved an exasperated sigh. To get any attention round here, you have to be a superjet or a turboprop, she said bitterly. You and your construction models. She piled the tray with the remains of supper and carried it over to the sink. She decided not to wash up, a necessity of daily life she always put off as long as possible. Instead, she piled everything into the sink haphazard, slipped on a corduroy jacket, and went out of the house, pausing to call over her shoulder, I'm just going to slip along to see Gladys Dixon. I want to borrow one of her Vogue patterns. All right, old girl. Jim bent over his model. Casting a venomous look at her next-door neighbour's front door as she passed, Cherry went round the corner into Blenheim Close and stopped at number 16. The door was open, and Cherry tapped on it and went into the hall, calling out, Is Gladdy about? Oh, is that you, Cherry? Mrs. Dixon looked out of the kitchen. She's upstairs in her room, dressmaking. Right, I'll go up. Cherry went upstairs to a small bedroom in which Gladys, a plump girl with a plain face, was kneeling on the floor, her cheeks flushed and several pins in her mouth, tacking up a paper pattern. Hello, Cherry. Look, I got a lovely bit of stuff at Harper's sale at Much Benham. I'm going to do that crossover pattern with frills again, the one I did in Terraline before. That'll be nice, said Cherry. Gladys rose to her feet, panting a little. Oh, got indigestion now, she said. You oughtn't to do dressmaking right after supper, said Cherry, bending over like that. I suppose I ought to slim a bit, said Gladys. She sat down on the bed. Any news from the studios? Asked Cherry, always avid for film news. Oh, nothing much. There's a lot of talk still. Marina Gregg came back on the set yesterday, and she created something frightful. What about? She didn't like the taste of her coffee. You know, they have coffee in the middle of the morning. She took one sip and said there was something wrong with it, which was nonsense, of course. There couldn't have been. It comes in a jug straight from the canteen. Of course, I always put hers in a special china cup.
rather posh, different from the others, but it's the same coffee. So there couldn't have been anything wrong with it, could there?
Nerves, I suppose, said Jerry.
What happened?
Oh, nothing. Mr. Rudd just calmed everyone down. He's wonderful that way. He took the coffee from her and poured it down the sink.
That seems to be rather stupid, said Cherry slowly.
Why? What do you mean?
Well, if there was anything wrong with it, now nobody will ever know.
Do you think there really might have been? Asked Gladys, looking alarmed.
Well, Cherry shrugged her shoulders. There was something wrong with her cocktail the day of the fete, wasn't there? So why not the coffee? If at first you don't succeed, try again.
Gladys shivered.
I don't half like it, Cherry, she said. Somebody's got it in for her, all right. She's had more letters, you know, threatening her.
And there was that bus business the other day.
What bus business?
A marble bust on the set. It's a corner of a room in some Austrian palace or other. Funny name, like Shop Brown. Pictures and china and marble bust. And this one was up on a bracket. Suppose it hadn't been pushed back enough. Anyway, a heavy lorry went past out in the road and jarred it off, right onto the chair where Marina sits for a big scene with Count somebody or other. Smashed to smithereens. Lucky they weren't shooting at the time. Mr. Rudd, he said not to say a word to her, and he put another chair there, and when she came yesterday and asked why the chair had been changed, he said the other chair was the wrong period, and this gave a better angle for the camera. But he didn't half like it, I can tell you that.
The two girls looked at each other.
It's exciting in a way, said Cherry slowly. And yet, it isn't. I think I'm going to give up working in the canteen at the studios.
Why?
Nobody wants to poison you. Or drop marble busts on your head.
No, but it's not always the person who's meant to get done in who gets done in. It may be someone else, like Heather Badcock that day.
True enough, said Cherry.
You know, said Gladys, I've been thinking. I was at the Hall that day, helping. I was quite close to them at the time. When Heather died... No, when she spilt the cocktail, all down her dress. Lovely dress it was, too. Royal blue nylon taffeta. She got it quite new for the occasion. And it was funny.
What was funny?
I didn't think anything of it at the time. But it does seem funny when I think it over.
Cherry looked at her expectantly. She accepted the adjective funny in the sense that it was meant. It was not intended humorously.
Oh, for goodness sake, what was funny? She demanded.
I'm almost sure she did it on purpose.
Spilt the cocktail on purpose?
Yes.
And I do think that was funny, don't you?
On a brand new dress? I don't believe it.
I wonder now, said Gladys, what Arthur Badcock will do with all Heather's clothes. That dress would clean all right. Or I could take out half a breadth. It's a lovely full skirt. Do you think Arthur Badcock would think it very awful of me if I wanted to buy it off him? It would hardly need any alteration. And it's lovely stuff.
You wouldn't, Cherry hesitated, mind?
Mind what?
Well, having a dress that a woman had died in. I mean, died that way.
Gladys stared at her.
I hadn't thought of that, she admitted.
She considered for a moment or two, then she cheered up.
"I can't see that it really matters," she said. "After all, every time you buy something second-hand, somebody's usually worn it who has died, haven't they?"
"Yes, but it's not quite the same."
"I think you're being fanciful," said Gladys. "It's a lovely bright shade of blue and really expensive stuff."
"About that funny business," she continued thoughtfully, "I think I'll go up to the hall tomorrow morning on my way to work and have a word with Mr. Giuseppe about it."
"Is he the Italian butler?"
"Yes.
He's awfully handsome. Flashing eyes. He's got a terrible temper. When we go and help there, he chiffies us girls something terrible." She giggled, "but none of us really mind. It can be awfully nice sometimes. Anyway, I might just tell him about it and ask him what I ought to do."
"I don't see that you've got anything to tell," said Sherry.
"Well, it was funny," said Gladys, defiantly clinging to her favourite adjective.
"I think," said Sherry, "that you just want an excuse to go and talk to Mr. Giuseppe. And you better be careful, my girl. You know what these wops are like. Affiliation orders all over the place. Hot-blooded and passionate, that's what these Italians are."
Gladys sighed ecstatically. Cherry looked at her friend's fat, slightly spotted face, and decided that her warnings were unnecessary. Mr. Giuseppe, she thought, would have better fish to fry elsewhere.
"Aha," said Dr. Haydock. "Unravelling, I see."
He looked from Miss Marple to a pile of fluffy white fleecy wool.
"You advised me to try unravelling if I couldn't knit," said Miss Marple.
"You seem to have been very thorough about it."
"I made a mistake in the pattern right at the beginning. That made the whole thing go out of proportion, so I've had to unravel it all. It's a very elaborate pattern, you see."
"What are elaborate patterns to you? Nothing at all."
"I ought really, I suppose, with my bad eyesight, stick to plain knitting."
"You'd find that very boring."
"Well, I'm flattered that you took my advice."
"Don't I always take your advice, Dr. Haydock?"
"You do when it suits you," said Dr. Haydock.
"Tell me, Doctor, was it really knitting you had in mind when you gave me that advice?"
He met the twinkle in her eyes and twinkled back at her.
"How are you getting on with unravelling the murder?" he asked.
"I'm afraid my faculties aren't quite what they were," said Miss Marple, shaking her head with a sigh.
"Nonsense," said Dr. Haydock. "Don't tell me you haven't formed some conclusions."
"Of course I have formed conclusions, very definite ones."
"Such as?" asked Haydock inquiringly.
"If the cocktail glass was tampered with that day, and I don't see quite how that could have been done..."
"May have had the stuff ready in an eyedropper," suggested Haydock.
"You're so professional," said Miss Marple admiringly. "But even then, it seems to me so very peculiar that nobody saw it happen."
"Murder should not only be done, but seen to be done, is that it?"
"You know exactly what I mean," said Miss Marple.
"Well, that was a chance the murderer had to take," said Haydock.
"Oh, quite so. I'm not disputing that for a moment. But there were... I have found by inquiry, and adding up the persons, at least 18 to 20 people on the spot. It seems to me that amongst 20 people, somebody must have seen that action occur."
Haydock nodded.
"One would think so, certainly. But obviously no one did."
"I wonder," said
said Miss Marple thoughtfully. What have you got in mind exactly?
Well, there are three possibilities. I'm assuming that at least one person would have seen something, one out of 20. I think it's only reasonable to assume that.
I think you're begging the question, said Haydock, and I can see looming ahead one of those terrible exercises in probability where six men have white hats and six men have black, and you have to work it out by mathematics, how likely it is that the hats will get mixed up and in what proportion. If you start thinking about things like that, you would go round the bend, let me assure you of that.
I wasn't thinking of anything like that, said Miss Marple. I was just thinking of what is likely.
Yes, said Haydock thoughtfully. You're very good at that. You always have been.
It is likely, you know, said Miss Marple, that out of 20 people, one at least should be an observant one.
I give in, said Haydock. Let's have the three possibilities.
I'm afraid I'll have to put them in rather sketchily, said Miss Marple. I haven't quite thought it out. Inspector Craddock, and probably Frank Cornish before him, will have questioned everybody who was there. So the natural thing would be that whoever saw anything of the kind would have said so at once.
Is that one of the possibilities?
No, of course it isn't, said Miss Marple, because it hasn't happened. What you have to account for is if one person did see something, why didn't that person say so?
I'm listening.
Possibility one, said Miss Marple, her cheeks going pink with animation. The person who saw it didn't realize what they had seen. That would mean, of course, that it would have to be a rather stupid person. Someone, let us say, who can use their eyes but not their brain. The sort of person who, if you asked them, did you see anyone put anything in Marina Gregg's glass, would answer, oh, no. But if you said, did you see anyone put their hand over the top of Marina Gregg's glass, would say, oh, yes, of course I did.
Haydock laughed. I admit, he said, that one never quite allows for the moron in our midst. All right. I grant you possibility one. The moron saw it. The moron didn't grasp what the action meant. And the second possibility?
Oh, this one's far-fetched, but I do think it is just a possibility. It might have been a person whose action in putting something in a glass was natural.
Wait, wait, explain that a little more clearly.
It seems to me nowadays, said Miss Marple, that people are always adding things to what they eat and drink. In my young days, it was considered to be very bad manners to take medicines with one's meals. It was on a par with blowing your nose at the dinner table. It just wasn't done. If you had to take pills or capsules or a spoonful of something, you went out of the room to do so. Well, that's not the case now. When staying with my nephew Raymond, I observed some of his guests seemed to arrive with quite a quantity of little bottles of pills and tablets. They take them with food or before food or after food. They keep aspirins and such things in their handbags and take them the whole time, with cups of tea or with their after-dinner coffee. You understand what I mean?
Oh, yes, said Dr. Haydock. I've got your meaning now.
And it's interesting. You mean that someone... He stopped.
Let's have it in your own words.
I meant, said Miss Marple, that it would be quite possible, audacious but possible, for someone to pick up that glass
which, as soon as it was in his or her hand, of course, would be assumed to be his or her own drink, and to add whatever was added quite openly. In that case, you see, people wouldn't think twice of it.
He or she couldn't be sure of that, though, Haydock pointed out.
No, agreed Miss Marple. It would be a gamble, a risk, but it could happen. And then, she went on, there's the third possibility.
Possibility one, a moron, said the doctor. Possibility two, a gambler. What's possibility three?
Somebody saw what happened and has held their tongue deliberately.
Haydock frowned. For what reason? He asked. Are you suggesting blackmail? If so,
said Miss Marple, it's a very dangerous thing to do.
Yes, indeed.
He looked sharply at the placid old lady with the white fleecy garment on her lap.
Is the third possibility the one you consider the most probable one?
No, said Miss Marple. I wouldn't go so far as that. I have, at the moment, insufficient grounds. Unless, she added carefully, someone else gets killed.
Do you think someone else is going to get killed?
I hope not, said Miss Marple. I trust and pray not. But it so often happens, Dr. Haydock. That's the sad and frightening thing. It so often happens.
Chapter 17. Ella put down the telephone receiver, smiled to herself, and came out of the public telephone box. She was pleased with herself.
Chief Inspector God Almighty Craddock, she said to herself, I'm twice as good as he is at the job. Variations on the theme of fly, all is discovered.
She pictured to herself with a good deal of pleasure the reactions recently suffered by the person at the other end of the line. That faint, menacing whisper coming through the receiver. I saw you. She laughed silently, the corners of her mouth curving up in a feline, cruel line. A student of psychology might have watched her with some interest. Never until the last few days had she had this feeling of power. She was hardly aware herself of how much the heady intoxication of it affected her. Damn that old woman, thought Ella. She could feel Mrs. Bantry's eyes following her as she walked up the drive. A phrase came into her head for no particular reason. The pitcher goes to the well once too often. Nonsense. Nobody could suspect that it was she who had whispered those menacing words. She sneezed. Damn this hay fever, said Ella Zielinski. When she came into her office, Jason Rudd was standing by the window. He wheeled round.
I couldn't think where you were. I had to go and speak to the gardener. There were...
She broke off as she caught sight of his face. She asked sharply, What is it? His eyes seemed set deeper in his face than ever. All the gaiety of the clown was gone. This man was under strain. She had seen him under strain before, but never looking like this. She said again, What is it? He held a sheet of paper out to her.
It's the analysis of that coffee. The coffee that Marina complained about and wouldn't drink.
You said it to be analyzed? She was startled. But you poured it away down the sink. I saw you.
His wide mouth curled up in a smile. I'm pretty good at sleight of hand, Ella, he said. You didn't know that, did you? Yes, I poured most of it away, but I kept a little. And I took it along to be analyzed.
End of disc 6.